Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week I thought we could take a nice early vacation together. Our guest is a literary hero of mine, Scarlett Thomas, the author of some of the most darkly playful, genre-defying works of literary acrobatics you'll ever read. They include 2019's boarding school gothic, Oligarchy, the puzzle box intrigue of Popco, and for me, her greatest work, The End of Mr. Y, a book that blends Matrix-level philosophical trickery with cursed tomes and homeopathy. It's one of my favourite books ever. Her newest novel, The Sleepwalkers, is just as hard to pin down in its way. It's a story of newlyweds with a secret on the holiday from hell. But of course, this being Scarlett Thomas, it turns out to be much, much more than that. Today, we talk about accidentally arriving at a genius structure, the many ways to build characters from scratch, the dark consequences of desire and sex gone too far, and how hotels are just inherently creepy when you think about it. My advice, don't think about it. If you like what you hear and you want more, the usual offer applies. For a few of your pounds, dollars or currency of choice, you can sign up to Patreon and get an absolute slew of extra episodes. They include candid reviews, deep dives into classic books, extra chat from the authors, and plus even more random stuff. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod, help me keep this show going, and get your reward for your kindness. But now, come with me to a sun-kissed island somewhere in the Mediterranean. It's hot and humid and a little bit sexy, but there's a storm for the ages on the horizon. Let's talk scared. Hi, Scarlett, and welcome to Talking Scared. How are you?
I'm really good, thank you, Neil. How are you?
I'm all the better for speaking to you, really. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm a big fan on Twitter, and I think what you do is amazing. So, I'm really, really pleased to be here.
Good. Well, let's keep this loving rolling, and I'll go next. I'll be honest with listeners about something. So I first reached out to you about a year ago now when you first mentioned The Sleepwalkers, your new novel. And all I'd heard was the title and the merest shadow of a synopsis. There was the chance that there could have been nothing scary or creepy about it at all. But I didn't care, because I was determined to get you on the show, because years ago you wrote a book that's very important to me. And what's the point in building your own podcast if you can't turn it into a self-indulgent way to meet your literary heroes? So, I mean, you won't be surprised to hear that previous book was The End of Mr. Y, which I hope anyone who hasn't read goes and reads on my recommendation. But the focus of this conversation is your new novel, The Sleepwalkers, which thankfully does turn out is creepy as all hell in its own special, tricksy way. So can you start us off, I suppose, by introducing this story for my listeners? Because it's a tricky one to untangle.
Yeah, thank you for saying all those nice things. And do go and read The End of Mr. Y, people, if you haven't, because I still really like it. You know, like when you write something years ago and then you grow up and you think, ooh, but I actually still really like that book. But The Sleepwalkers is, I tell people that it is basically about a couple who have just learnt a really terrible secret about themselves at their own wedding. They've gone on their honeymoon to a Greek island. There they kind of refuse to talk about this secret that they've learnt, but nevertheless their relationship starts to unravel, and then I usually tell people, and then they break up and then everyone dies. But that's not really a spoiler, because that's not exactly what does happen. but I feel, yeah, people like to know that everyone dies at the end of a book. The concept of breaking up on a honeymoon is, I suppose, one of the big things in the book.
Yeah, it is. You've made it sound a lot more soapy than it is, right? It's not that. Although I suppose it is quite melodramatic in a way, right?
Yeah, so one of the things that I was kind of inspired by the concept of sensation fiction, which is quite melodramatic. And so it's kind of 19th century form, as you know, because I think you probably know more about this stuff than I do. But I'm really interested in the kind of visceral reactions to stories and those moments where you kind of gasp or feel really unsettled. And so I suppose some of the melodrama feeds into that. And there are some really big reveals in this book. But it is also kind of subtle, I hope. And certainly the first section, which is a letter from the main character, Evie, to her husband, kind of telling him why she's leaving him. But that is very much about this relationship that Evie has with this hotel owner called Isabella, and the concept of is Isabella gaslighting Evie, and who's reading the situation correctly. And it's quite, that's quite subtle. I hope you thought so too.
I very much did, yeah. And I've got all sorts of questions about it.
Okay, all right, sorry.
No, not at all. It's good that we're on the same page. But my first question is really one about sort of genre and descriptors, because there's a lovely phrase I keep seeing about this book. It keeps being described as a piece of vacation gothic, which is something, there's a quite charming idea to that, because I find hotels inherently creepy. But gothic fiction, it's such a damn mutable category. And in this story, there are no castles, there are no ghosts or generational curses. And if there is a gothic heroine, she's certainly not dashing about in her nightdress. So in what way do you consider it to be a gothic novel?
Yes, I do. I hadn't actually seen the vacation gothic tag, but I was describing it as hot gothic at one point. Yeah, that kind of, I don't know, that gothic feeling of being on holiday. And so, okay, no castle, but there is a creepy-ish house. And that, I guess, it's a feature or a trope of the gothic that you feel trapped in a place somehow. And I think I've got a massive storm to make up for the lack of castle. But I mean, I've been kind of exploring the gothic for a little while now. Obviously, there was The End of Mr. Y back in 2007, but also my previous novel, Oligarchy, which is about a bunch of girls at a boarding school who, it's like a dark comedy about eating disorders, but that uses a few gothic tropes as well. Yeah, so basically, yes, vacation gothic, but hot gothic, let's call it that.
I like hot gothic, yeah. When I, back in my gothic studies days, when everyone was looking for the new category they could kind of make their own and write a thesis about, hot gothic would have been quite the thing to get to grips with. If anyone listens, I have a few academic friends listen to this, I guarantee there'll be a thesis on hot gothic coming out sometime in 2025.
Oh, excellent.
You mentioned sensation literature, and the only thing I know about that is kind of like Wilkie Collins and the Moonstone and stuff like that. That kind of slightly more lurid version that went alongside Dickens and things. You know, it was the two strands of Victorian fiction. And I think this has got that similar adjacency to gothic. You know, it's just a little bit off to one side in the way that sensation fiction was. But you've always experimented with form and genres in your career. I've not read everything, but I've read quite a bit. You do seem to take a very different voice in each book. Often you'll take a really sort of offbeat central conceit and build a story around it and build your form and your storytelling medium around it. And in this one, well, maybe you need to explain a little the structure to answer this question, but why did you choose the particular form and conceit that you chose in The Sleepwalkers?
So this might upset some of the academics, if there are any, and if they care about this kind of thing, but it was all a complete accident, with no intention behind it whatsoever, at the beginning at least. So I teach creative writing, and one of the things I like to teach sometimes is how accident is so important in storytelling and the things that you didn't plan, and then almost kind of retrofitting a kind of intentionality to what you've created, if that doesn't sound too weird. So the project really started as a short story. It was just the letter that this woman writes to her husband, telling him why she's breaking up with him, and this weird woman that's kind of been gaslighting her in the hotel that they've stayed in. And that was it. That was the project. And then I'm trying to remember if I decided I was going to lie about this or not, but it's too late now. Anyway, so that was basically it. And then I was really kind of pleased with what I'd done, and I really liked it. And at some point I thought, well, what if Evie was right and this hotel owner, Isabella, was fucking with her in some way? And so part of it is that the hotel owner is kind of flirting with the husband all the time, and and she's really nice to him and really horrible to Evie, and he doesn't see it. So it's that situation where Evie gets more and more unsettled, and then there's one point when Richard kind of, you know, shouts at her, why can't you just be a bit nicer to Isabella? And this is kind of the last straw, almost, for Evie. So then I wondered, well, if Evie was right, then what would happen next? And what if Richard had, that's the husband, what if he had something to say? So then I started experimenting with the letter that he writes back. But then, of course, I had to think, well, okay, she's leaving him, so does he get her letter? And in what circumstances is he writing back? And then, so you get Evie's letter and then Richard's letter. And then I got obsessed with this idea of documents which are hidden in plain sight. So this came out of actually a writing residency I had in a whiskey distillery on an island in the Inner Hebrides back in the days when they used to have that kind of thing for writers. They don't really do that anymore. Anyway, and they had these artfully curated objets everywhere. Like there was a suit of armor, and there were bits of deer, antlers, whips, all kinds of things. And then there were these piles of documents tied up with string that looked like old letters, you know, from, you know, the 19th century or whatever. And you obviously weren't meant to untie the string and read them. But once I'd written two of these letters, I thought, well, what if there were a couple more notes? And what if there were other documents that somebody had collected? And what if they were left around the hotel as a kind of decoration and nobody would ever read them? But what if one of them told this desperately sad story of this breakup and some other shocking things about what's really happening at this hotel? So there's, yeah, in the end, there are several letters, including one you don't expect to get. Plus, there's an audio transcript, which Evie has recorded at quite a dramatic moment. But the crucial thing about the audio transcript is it does what all voice recognition does, which is to get quite a lot of words wrong. So that's in there as well. And I think each time with each new artifact, I thought, oh, I want to build the story more in this direction or that direction. And then it did come together like a weird bundle of documents. Sorry, that was a really long answer.
No, it's what you're here for. But I loved it because I love found footage, you know, I've written on this extensively that the modern, well, it's kind of past now, but the early part of this century, the obsession that we had with found footage and horror, a lot of people thought that was like a new thing. Oh, isn't the Blair Witch fascinating? You know, if you go back to the very, very, very origins of Gothic in like the, you know, the 1700s, they're all about found documents. All of those stories hinge on a diary that gets found or a letter that gets found. So like found footage and or found documentation is at the bedrock of this genre. And I did all my study into that on, like, you know, books that are about their own realities as text and things like that. So you can imagine my delight when I discovered that this was an assemblage of found documents. But the book opens with a very strange contents page. And at first I had no idea why you'd included that. But then I was taught, reflected on it, and I thought, in a way, you could argue that the actual story of this book is how that compilation of documents that is the book comes to be. Is that fair to say?
Yes, definitely. That's a really great question. It's quite hard to answer because this is a really complicated book in terms of how it's structured and the status of the artifacts that you think you're reading. And if you really attend carefully to the contents list and what's there, and then read the book and see what you've actually got, what you've read. There's some differences. So what I want is for the reader to wonder about the status of the texts that they've read, where they came from, why they've been put into this collection, why something's missing from the collection. Yeah, there's quite a lot going on there, and it's all extremely deliberate, including, and this hopefully isn't much of a spoiler, but the book ends halfway through a sentence. Which is way more satisfying than it probably sounds, if you've been paying attention. Although I have to say that I did have one agent, not my actual literary agent, but somebody on the screen side, who read the book and thought it was an error and that she was missing a page, which did make me worry. Yeah, I thought it would be quite obvious by the time you got to the end why it might end halfway through a sentence. But anyway, yeah, it's a tricksy structure, put it that way.
Without being a dick, is it not quite alarming when somebody responsible for selling your book doesn't get like the, because it you like you say, you lay out a lot of the critical apparatus to understand why that ending is the ending it is. It's a strange one to get there and not get why.
I know. I mean, I've been in this business for a long time. I'm sure you have too. And you know, you see everything after a certain amount of time, and nothing is shocking anymore. So yeah, I mean, people, you know, do they read things properly? Do they skim? Do they get the assistant to read it? Do they just not care? And you know, I guess when those things happen, you have to ask yourself, well, have I not done my job properly? You know, because you have to, you know, you want somebody to be sort of gripped and involved by what you've done. So, but anyway, yeah, me and this person are no more.
Okay, right. It's probably for the best. Because don't get me wrong, this is a book you could easily need help understanding. You know, it's a tricksy book. It's complex in all kinds of different ways, formally, narratively, structurally. But there's interpretation and there's, I think, skim reading, and they're two different things.
Yeah, 100%.
Now, a word I don't use much anymore is postmodern, because I mean we've touched on gothic, and now we're going to touch on postmodern. You know, the two most elusive, ill-defined terms in all of fiction, and that and postmodern in particular is a whole can of worms. But I do think you could easily call yourself a postmodern author if you wanted to, and do you? And if what and what does if you do, what does postmodern mean to you?
Oh wow.
Yeah, I mean,
I
just I
feel
mean,
like
I might as well actually solve the Middle East crisis. You know what I mean? Just define postmodern for me.
I literally feel like I'm back in 1995 taking my final exams for my cultural
Sorry.
studies degree. That's fine. Slightly traumatic, slight PTSD. But it's yeah, that's such a great question because of course postmodern, you know, when I was I suppose writing more about the term and thinking about it like in the 90s and the early 2000s, it kind of meant contemporary and now, like it meant Beavis and Butthead and it meant, you know, Ren and Stimpy and, you know, those radio shows where they'd like be a bit stupid and talk about going out the night before and our self-referentiality and intertextuality and Quentin Tarantino and all of that. But now, of course, you say any of that stuff to the younger students I teach, and they're just like, don't know what you're talking about. And so the postmodern is now kind of retro, like it's nostalgic, it's in the past. And one of the features of postmodernism is to have a kind of nostalgia mode anyway, right? For, you know, retro stuff from before. So it's a bit of a mind fuck, isn't it, to think that I might still be writing in this mode, which is supposedly so contemporary, but now it's kind of maybe passé. But with all those terms in the, you know, in that period of high theory, you were supposed to go, no, I'm not a post-structuralist, or no, I'm not a postmodernist. Like, even the structuralists and the post-structuralists, they would just reject every term. And so I guess to remain cool, I've got to say, no, I'm not a postmodern author, but I probably am.
I think it's one of those things where there's postmodern with a big P and a small P. You know, like when you said, like, it takes you back to 1995, there is something of the late 90s about this book that I love. You know, the well, as we said, Chuck Palahniuk, Douglas Copeland, you know, people like that who I came up reading and that informed my imagination so much, particularly in that focus on the act of writing and reading and really embodying the reading. So you've got to think of, I mean, you talk about visceral, you know, this book is kind of intellectually visceral. It forces you to actually confront the fact that you are reading and that you are interpreting. You cannot do that passively when you're reading The Sleepwalkers. It's an entirely active reading experience. And that, to me, is all the postmodern stuff. But I think you are right. In some ways, a lot of it's become passé. The self-referentiality has become passé. And I think almost we are arguably post-postmodern now, where postmodern with a capital P is now the thing that we are parodying. You know, that was always about parody, but now it's the target of parody. So we've kind of gone right through the looking glass and back round on ourselves.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think, yeah, like heartfelt postmodernism, you know, what is that? And I used to, I mean, at university and then in my early teaching days, you know, we used to do Baudrillard and hyperreality. And I think the future that we were describing back then seems almost quaint now compared with what we actually have. So I think the fact that everything is so messed up and that, you know, so incredibly hyperreal and so on is, it has forced us back into a kind of real caring. You know, we're not floating on the surface laughing at everything anymore. It's, you know, we've been sucked into something that's properly dark. I think actually, you know, with Gen Z, they're coming back to that kind of thinking as well, that they, you know, they care a lot more, I think, about reality. Yeah.
Late millennials like me, we were the worst generation. We didn't care about anything. We just riffed along on like false nostalgia and Smirnoff Ice, and we didn't give a shit. And yeah, the 90s was a time of angst and political activism and motivation, and we've come back to that. But yeah, the 20 years of me being young was just, what a waste.
Well, at least you had a good time, probably.
Yeah. I mean, everyone else had expense, right? But yeah, I had a great time. We've talked about a lot of highfalutin things here. I mean, definitions of postmodernism in the first 50 minutes of a conversation, that is a big ask. Yeah, I'm gonna have to, let's bring things back down to slightly more fun, earthier things. I think, for all its trickery, The Sleepwalkers is your most overtly thriller-esque book in a good while. Oligarchy was, but this feels much more, I don't know, alongside all the trickery, there's a very kind of straightforward through line in a way. I don't want to say generic because the term gets taken the wrong way, but it does have these overt thriller tendencies, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Was that a conscious project?
No, because it wasn't a conscious project. It really, like I say, you know, it really did kind of come together in this slightly haphazard, chaotic, quite exciting way. And the project I'm working on now is much more like I've got an intention with it, and, you know, to some extent I am kind of following through with that. Whereas The Sleepwalkers wasn't really meant to be a thriller at the beginning, but once I realized that I had this married couple and they had two different views of what was going on at this hotel, and then once we had this idea of the sleepwalkers, so that's the title of the novel, but the sleepwalkers as characters in the novel are a second husband and wife who had been to the island the year before, and they've drowned in a storm. And they also stayed at Isabella's hotel, the Villa Rosa. And so the one thing that seems to keep Evie and Richard kind of interested and given them something to talk about is this story of the sleepwalkers and what happened to them. And this husband and wife, you know, he went sleepwalking and walked into the sea in the storm, and she loved him so much she went in afterwards to try and save him, and then they both drowned. Once I had that, then I knew I had a kind of murder mystery structure, very light murder mystery structure, I suppose, which is the same in Oligarchy, and it's a structure I really like to return to. And it's such a fundamental fictional structure. And then the question of what happened to the sleepwalkers and what will happen to Evie and Richard when they find that out. But then there's also, without giving too many spoilers, there's a slice of hand element, because, you know, what you think you're looking at is not really what you're looking at. And so the idea of things being hidden, again, hidden in plain sight, or, you know, you're looking over here, but what's happening over there? What did you not notice? Becomes really key. So, yeah, there's the standard thriller element, and then there's the actual scary stuff that you didn't even think about, perhaps, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm just stressing that, as I always do when I go off on these flights of academic wank, because I don't want people to think this is some dry...
Yeah, sorry, I've gone with you on that.
I want to just bring people back down to understand this is a compelling story that I read in like 2 days. it is great. It's just also, it makes you think about the act of storytelling. One of the things that you're known for, or at least to me, but which you actually don't do in The Sleepwalkers, but in your other books, you're known for folding really complex philosophical or scientific theories into your fiction while still keeping them hugely readable. Maybe in this one, it's that rather than folding in the theory, you do this narrative trickery, you know, which is the offset against the readability maybe. But I mean, the end of Mr. Y is forefront for me in that, because it brings in all kinds of philosophical ideas and stuff about reality and all sorts of theory. How do you do that? Why do you do it? It seems such a difficult thing to like aim for.
Yes, I was gonna, I was going to apologize for the academic wank, but there might be more. I'm going to try not to.
You're amongst friends, trust me. After 180 episodes, okay. I am an academic wanker, and people are okay with this, so it's fine.
Okay. So yeah, I feel like there are, if you're going to do big ideas in books, if you're going to do a kind of novel of ideas, as they used to call it, I feel like there are two ways of doing it. One is you get all your characters to sit down over dinner and talk about the ideas. And I think in my earlier novels, there was quite a lot of that, especially the end of Mr. Y. Let's think about what phenomenology is, and let's all sit down and discuss it. And then let's run around a bit, you know, men, guns, time travel. Now let's sit down and have another conversation about philosophy. And then, I don't know, just thinking that there's a different type of novel of ideas where you just dramatize the ideas. So no one ever sits down and talks about the theories or the concepts, but you kind of, you know, it's a form of show, don't tell, I suppose. And it kind of hit me about, you know, 6 or 7 years ago that I could try doing the other one. It's quite freeing in a way. I think perhaps if readers don't necessarily see what you're doing or think about it, perhaps they think the books have got less intellectual content because people aren't literally kind of ramming it down your throat. But yeah, I don't know. Who knows? I might go back to having more long conversations about philosophy in future books. But yeah, I've dropped it for the last few. Definitely.
So where do you see that shift happening? What book was the hinge point?
Well, let's see. I suppose it started to shift a bit in The Seed Collectors, but there was still a lot of talk about botany and stuff. And that was still, so I used to be a research junkie, and I would do these extreme research performances, let's call it that. You know, for Popco, I learned loads about code breaking, and I shut myself up in Torquay Library and, you know, war stuff and strategy and pirates and all kinds of things. And then for The Seed Collectors, I actually signed up to do an MSc in ethnobotany, which is people and plants, in the anthropology department here at the University of Kent. And I didn't finish it because it turns out I'm quite flaky as a student of something I wasn't very good at. And so I was still in that phase of, I'm going to learn a lot about a subject and then I'm going to sneak it into the book, or not that sneakily because everyone could see it. And then I think because of my extreme research, and also because I had a strange tangent where I tried to become like a semi-professional tennis player and failed and wrote a weird nervous breakdown memoir about it, I think that was probably the point, you know, the nervous breakdown point, or you have to rebuild yourself and do things differently. So I wrote three kids' books, which are kind of joyful and weird. And then I guess I sort of came back with Oligarchy a bit different, a bit kind of gothic, a bit shorter, a bit more storytelling led. But I don't know where I'll go from here. The next book is partly all about the Book of Jonah from the Old Testament. So maybe we're back on the research thing.
It's quite a ricocheting career, because what we haven't mentioned is you began your career with a series of murder mysteries.
Yeah.
Featuring the same character. I haven't read those stories, I confess, but that's a major leap from that to then things like, you know, Bright Young Things and Popco and Mr. Y. So there's been several, as I say, ricocheting points in your career.
Yeah, yeah.
And the listeners have now all picked their ears up and gone, hang on, what was this about a tennis player? But I mean, you've talked about that to death, so I don't want to make you go over those calls again. But what's the book that, I mean, but feel free to speak about it, but what's the book that details that journey?
So the book is called 41 Love, and it's actually only published in the US. It's not published in the UK because I set out to write a happy memoir about how you can be a woman in her early 40s doing sports and it can be lovely. And in fact, like, it became so dark and obsessive and addictive. And you see, there's a part of me, I guess it's partly why I'm on this podcast, that for me, the connection between horror and humour and awfulness and laughing at it and, you know, just the tone of the book is quite weird, because I set off on this memoir journey, but it soon becomes dark, but then I decide to go with it. So it's just this memoir of obsession with, you know, trying to win, being unable to win, weirdly. I just couldn't do it. I think I won once in the whole, it was like a year. And then allowing the absurdism and the humour to be there all the time. It's a book that not everybody would like, but it's one of my favourite things that I've written, because it was just so authentic to how I was in that very, very strange year. And there's loads about tennis and sport and other fucked up tennis players. And for people that like a fucked up tennis memoir, Andre Agassi's book is incredible too, and so scary. Like, if your listeners like scary, that is a scary book.
Because of his obsession?
Well, actually, in Andre Agassi's case, his father, so it's a bit like Venus and Serena Williams. It was like a tennis father, and tennis fathers are like horror figures.
Yeah.
In fact,
like theatre moms in tracksuits, right?
Yeah. Do you know, I'm sure you do, the Teddy Perkins episode of Atlanta, the super gothic horror?
I haven't seen it, but I'm aware of the phenomenon of Teddy Perkins.
I mean, if you haven't seen it, I really, really heartily recommend it. It's one of my favourite things. And in that, there's stuff about like the pushy father. So Andre Agassi's father was just terrifying. And I think when Andre Agassi was 9 years old, the father set him up to play some dude at their local tennis club and put a bet on of $10,000 that his 9-year-old son could beat this guy. And so then imagine you're the 9-year-old boy that has to go out and kick this guy's ass, or your dad's going to lose 10 grand. So yeah, that book was pretty dark too.
Yeah, that's healthy.
Yeah.
Sorry, you sent me sidetracked here by thinking about Atlanta, because I've only seen bits of it. But you know, one of those things that kind of percolates through by osmosis, and you're kind of aware of more of it than you should be. I haven't seen much. I'm very, very aware of it. And it's really striking me that there are similarities between Atlanta and your work, in that, you know, the tonal inconsistencies, the bouncing around, the playfulness, all of that stuff. And that just interested me. But it leads into my next question, I suppose, which, did you draw on any direct inspirations for the Sleepwalkers?
Yes. And a big one was Wilkie Collins, actually. The Woman in White, though, not the Moonstone. And how much of a roller coaster that book is, that, you know, once you start reading it and, you know, there's a woman in white and is she a ghost? And then, without wanting to give spoilers for, you know, what is a very twisty turny book, all the gothic elements, the sensation fiction elements, and just how incredibly readable and gripping it is. So that was probably the main one. And then I tend to forget all my influences. They're all written in a note somewhere that I forgot to look at to, like, revise. But
well, has anyone ever suggested a sort of correlation with Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl?
Oh, no, you see, I never read that, because I retained that stupid, like, how to be cool in the 1990s thing, which I never grew out of, which is, if something's popular and everyone's doing it, like, you don't read it, not even in secret. Right. So yeah. there's so much that I just don't know. Shirley Jackson is a big influence, I suppose.
Oh, okay. Credited person on this podcast. No one gets like Shirley.
I know, it's funny, isn't it? And it's like she just had a real moment, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, and now everyone's all Shirley. But yeah, I guess there's a reason. I mean, she's amazing.
And what was it about Shirley Jackson?
Again, it's the darkness of the humour. And yeah, is it just that when humour gets really dark, it becomes a kind of horror or starts to lean into the gothic? Or is it just that when horror and gothic become really themselves, they just become funny? And I think she's just really good in that kind of place. I've got something to recommend later of hers.
Okay. And Patricia Highsmith is the other one as well that I think you've probably heard before. Like that, the weird psychological geometries of these characters that reminded me very much of something like the Ripley books, you know.
The first Ripley book was a big influence on the Sleepwalkers, although I have to say I'm a big abandoner of books, so I'll read half a book and then think, oh, I'm done now. Or I read do you remember what was it called, the Susanna Clarke, the big Susanna Clarke novel,
Mr. Norrell, Jonathan Strange and Mr.
Yeah, Norrell. That one. Yeah, I actually read probably about 7/8 of that book and then gave it up. So, which, it was a thick book, if you remember. So with Ripley, I read about half of the first one and I was like, this is amazing, I love the writing, but I see what you're doing and it's fine. But I've got some student work to read now. So that's what I always do. I come out into student work and then I never go back in unless it's amazing.
I have to finish every book I start now for this podcast, except what I do is I try and carve out these weeks where I get to read something that isn't horror, and I'll start it. Like I just started Liu Cixin's, you know, The Three-Body Problem. I started the third book and then got 200 pages in and started to panic that I won't have time to read the next book for the podcast, and always start that early, therefore negating my week off. I never, ever stop reading the book I'm starting for the show, but there's a trail of unfinished books that I, quote, quote, want to read that I never get to finish. Such is life.
Yes.
We've talked for like well over half an hour here. Haven't mentioned the characters at all, really. And I want to get into it, because that's where like the real joy of this book is. You've got the whole stuff with the cool technique of it and the assemblage of documents, but the characters are where it sings. You've got Evelyn and you've got Richard, this couple who found out something dreadful on their wedding day and got on honeymoon anyway. Evelyn is a wonderful character, but she's a real bundle of juxtapositions. She was poor, now she's kind of quite gaucely rich. She's romantic, but also quite brittle. She's vulnerable, but also cruel in parts. And I kept thinking throughout, is a character like that artfully and intentionally constructed? Or do you think that level of contradiction is just what makes her an everywoman?
Good question. Or is it just a mistake? No, it's not. it's really interesting creating characters, and so many different ways to do it. I mean, you can be quite structured and scientific about it, and I teach Stanislavski's concept of the super objective, you know, back from like method acting and, you know, early 20th century Russian theatre, where, you know, every character is held together by this one central desire that they have for something big, like control or power or to be loved or something. So you can almost set out, you know, you can go, well, here's my character and this is what they really want and this is what they're like. I'm going to build them up from this. Even though I teach all that stuff, the way I do it is way more haphazard and accidental than that. So, you know, with Evie, I just... well, actually, full disclosure, I essentially went on exactly this holiday with my partner, and we had the same arguments. We hadn't just got married, and we don't have the big secret, but the argument about Isabella, she wasn't called Isabella, I don't think. But the arguments around that were the same. So at first I just started to pull Evelyn out of that part of myself, which was this kind of, you know, this woman in this relationship who is having this big argument with their partner. And then, of course, as the story developed, I had to build her up a bit more from there and give her a backstory. And it's always such an issue when you're a writer and you want to make all your characters writers, but you can't because that's stupid. So you have to give them something vaguely artistic that they've done that isn't writing. So Evie's thing is like one woman shows and theatre. Yeah, then I just had a lot of fun with her, really building up, you know, how she came to be who she is. And I used my experience with Oligarchy, so the previous book. It was the first time I'd had a lot of screen interest for TV rights for Oligarchy. And so I had lots of, you know, I had lots of meetings, and there was an auction for the rights, and it all went horribly wrong after that. But there was a period of time where it looked like it might be really successful and really take off, and I might be involved in it. So I actually took all of those feelings I'd had about that and gave them to Evie as her feelings about her one woman show that's kind of become really successful, a bit like Fleabag, but then she's sort of been slightly cancelled, and so she's, you know, she's kind of hit some heights and then hit failure again and wants to build her career back up. So yeah, a lot of that was sort of semi-autobiographical.
Okay. And then the flip side is Richard.
Bless him. Yeah.
I'm glad you said that, right? Because this is where we're going to tiptoe towards revelations that I'm not going to make.
Okay. Yes.
But we find out certain things about Richard, and I still can't work out, because this book is all about different people's interpretations for a start, but you can't even trust Richard's interpretation of his own story for various reasons. And I can't work out if he is a victim or a monster. And more importantly, I can't work out if you want us to think he's a victim or a monster.
Oh, good, then my job is done. Yeah, but not everybody likes that, of course. but yeah, I mean, that, you know, that is, I guess it's one of the big questions of the book is who is victim, who is perpetrator? And when you look at terrible things that people do or have done to them, can you take it back a level? Was there somebody else? Was there something or somebody that made that person act that way. I guess another question, you know, to what extent are our actions all our own free will and our own choice? To what extent are we coerced or gaslit or groomed into certain actions? And then if we have been, say, groomed into doing something, who did that? But then does it stop with them, or was there somebody behind that person? And where do bad actions originate is a big question of the book, I think. So and Richard, I'm probably fonder of him than many readers will be, but yeah, I'm possibly still working with Richard in some ways, but I won't say any more about that just now.
Okay,
but yeah,
okay.
He's yeah, so were you really caught 50-50 between he's a monster and he's a victim, or did you come down on either side in the end?
It's a complex question, right? And I need to be clear, because the lack of nuance is the reason I find him such an uncomfortable character, because we live in a world now where everything is black and white. And this is a difficult one to talk about without giving away what's gone on with Richard as well. But he's, I won't use the phrase done things. He has been involved in things that if those things were discussed in the tabloids or on social media, he would be demonized without question outright. And I think your book forces us to confront that monsters, well, I think monster is too, is that perpetrators can be victims, and also that the actual, the misdemeanors, as bad as they may also have mitigating factors. And we now live in an era in which that, even saying that, has become a very, very problematic thing to say. So I think I'll put it this way. I really sympathize with Richard, but I felt like I had someone looking over my shoulder and I had to kind of justify my sympathy.
Yes. And you're quite right. I mean, we live in strange times in which we're expected to judge one another at levels I've never experienced before, and to kind of perform a kind of judgment as well. I suppose one of the features of everything I've tried to do is to try and see the basic humanity in everybody. I guess that is what, you know, good fiction, if we're trying to write good fiction, you know, that's what good fiction should always do, I think. I think that kind of black and white thinking doesn't translate over that well into fiction. You know, it's fine for a bit of a Twitter spat or a newspaper column, but fiction has to keep hold of that idea that it's not that simple. It's never that simple. But I guess not everybody will agree. But,
no. But I think we could do with more people agreeing. It would probably correct some of the ways that society has gone wrong, I think, if people just acknowledge that exactly what you said. Yeah. But even having this conversation starts to sound worryingly like being that guy in the pub going, you can't say anything anymore. You know,
these young people.
Yeah, endlessly trying to justify your point of view by going like, I'm not saying that, I'm just saying this, and it becomes a nightmare. But I think the thing that also saves Richard here, he is so unintentionally funny, because he has these, like you said, bless him, he has these psychosexual hang-ups. There's one line I just highlighted that just made me howl laughing, because it's the prurient way in which he says it. He says, well, he writes it, most women don't realise the erotic power of a pair of simple, clean, white pants. Only real animals get off on the idea of a thong, surely. And I was just like, but then as the book goes on, it's like you're trying to pull the rug on the reader, because I laughed at that. And then later, when you put the kind of psychological jigsaw together, even that statement takes on a much darker meaning when you understand why he's got this view of sex.
Yes, it's funny, because I've long had this ambition to write a book with no humour at all, like completely. And in fact, that's where Richard came from, because I'm working on a book at the moment which may still have Richard in it.
Right.
And it was interesting when I was coming up with his character, I thought he was going to be in a different book. And then I thought, wait, no, this is actually Evie's husband that I'm working on. This is who I've discovered. But he stayed in the other book as well. So it's kind of interesting, under a slightly different name for kind of interesting reasons. And one of my notes for the other book is this will be a book without humor, that this is a guy who takes everything so seriously and his whole world is serious. His spreadsheets, his running stats, his goals, his financial world, everything is so serious. But then, of course, as soon as you start working with that, I mean, it's like where horror meets humor.
Yeah, that
It's the
can't not
very,
become
yeah,
funny.
right, exactly. And so, yeah, it kind of gave me a real pleasure to lean into his earnestness and, his ideas about underwear and women and innocence and yeah, I'm trying to think if it's a spoiler or not, but well, so Evie's whole thing is that she thinks that Richard kind of fancies Isabella and he keeps denying it. And then there's a moment where he sort of accidentally sleeps with Isabella that I particularly enjoyed writing. The way he tries to explain it to Evie, and honestly, I thought she was you. Oh, well, it gave me a fun morning's writing.
Yeah, he's kind of like one of those Instagram like productivity bros, isn't he? You're the one like I get up at 4 a.m. and I'm in my mind palace and I go for a run and like you say, his
Yes.
spreadsheets everything. But he's kind of like he's a failed, slightly pathetic version of that. He can't even fully commit to the rigor. He just accidentally sleeps with somebody, genuinely accidentally sleeps with her, and it's yeah, he is. He did make me laugh a lot. But here's a question, because we've kind of touched on this now. So your books, as I've said, typically come with some sort of disciplinary prefix, right? There's the puzzle novel, Popko, the philosophical novel, Mr. Y, or you could append a lot of things to that. Oligarch is a campus novel. Not to sort of join in with the reductiveness, but is the Sleepwalkers your sex novel?
Well, now that is an interesting question. No, if you've missed out on The Seed Collectors, that's the sex novel. That
Funny, because that's the one I haven't read. Right,
right,
okay.
there you go. That's the sex novel because the sex in that novel actually upset quite a lot of people. Because so one of the ideas of The Seed Collectors is it's about botany, and botany is biology, and biology is sex, right? So it's probably the most sexual of the books, but then the end of Mr. Y's got a lot of sex in it as well. And I think sometimes when I realize the amount of sex that I put in the books, I slightly kind of feel a bit freaked out and like, oh wow, did I think that, or did I actually write that down, or did I publish that? Oh no, you know. And then, but actually, over the years, readers have been great. Like, no one's been embarrassing, no one's said anything dirty. Like, I've never, I mean, please don't take this as, an invitation, anyone out there, but I've never had a weird thing about the sex in the books, except for one email that I didn't read to the end of that came from an American woman about how much she hated what I'd done in The Seed Collectors. But that was it. Apart from that, all these years, like weird sex in little chef toilets. Actually, one of my older colleagues here, because I used to be young when I wrote The End of Mr. Y, and I was, here in the university, and she shouted up the stairs at me, "What was all that about the pink soap, Scarlett?" I was like, "Don't say that. Just don't. Like, we don't say these things out loud." So yes, okay, is this the sex novel? So no, but yes, because I think here I am grappling with it a bit more, and grappling with how wrong sexuality can go in some ways, and
Yeah.
and the kind of dark gothic consequences of that, and what can go wrong with a certain kind of desire, and so on. So yes, why not? It can be, yes, along with the
Because
Seed Collectors.
what I meant by that was not to just reduce it to one thing, but I don't really mean about the actual scenes of sex, which are throughout your work. I mean the fact that in this one, sex seems to be the central pivot of the story. Or if there is a kind of theoretical framework to it, it seems to be about sex and power, you know. And just like I asked you about Richard being a monster or a victim, there's a similar parallel question of whether Evelyn's sexuality makes her powerful or vulnerable. Because it seems to me that men continually try to degrade her, but she wields a strange kind of control within that. And it makes for a kind of uncomfortable but fascinating read. There's one scene where a friend of her husband's is washing her hair and she's knelt by the bath. And there's a sort of dark erotic power, a real frisson that I felt. Again, like a visceral feeling. Like, and later on that becomes retrospectively very dark because of things we find out. But yeah, it feels like there's a tension between the male attempts to mistreat and degrade Evelyn and her kind of, you know, just use of that, I suppose.
Yes, and how I think with both Richard and Evie, there are quite innocent aspects of their sexuality that can be reframed in ways that are more disturbing. So I suppose, you know, if you're a woman and you have slightly submissive tendencies, or if, you know, you quite like the feeling sometimes of, I don't know, wearing certain clothes, or, you know, being, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, people talk about kink and stuff now, don't they? And it's like everything's fine. Everything you could possibly find sexually arousing is kind of fine if it's framed like that. But then what if those kinks or desires also put you in a position where you're powerless in a bad way, or that, you know, you could be exploited or oppressed? And also, I suppose, what if, you know, some of our desires and pleasures that are almost like, you know, products we might consume, like especially if it's porn or whatever, that, you know, how is that stuff made and where does it come from? You know, are there unwholesome things that can feed a wholesome desire? So it's, again, we're in the realm of real complication there, where, you know, there's nothing wrong with anyone feeling anything, wanting anything, or, you know, you can still think what you like and get aroused by what you like, but then how does that play out, you know, in the material world, I suppose? So that is kind of one of the questions.
Yeah, and that ethical stuff that you mentioned, like, you know, where does the porn come from? Where does, you know, people in sex work, what's their origin story? Without giving too much away, that links into another theme of the book that's one of the main thriller arcs, the story that we haven't touched upon and won't touch upon, but I can see how that, you know, comes in at an adjacency and links to that as well, as in what Isabella is really doing in this hotel.
Yeah, absolutely. And even then, I suppose, to what extent is sex a kind of sleight of hand, kind of look at this shiny thing over here, which everybody's interested in pretty much, you know, here's the sex over here, but over there is something that's more mundane, but also, you know, very disturbing. So what are we not looking at? You know, when we're following the sex story, what are we not seeing behind that? So yeah, kind of wanting to play with that as well, I think.
Yeah. The other woman we haven't, well, that I haven't really asked about yet, you've mentioned it, but I haven't delved into her any further, is Isabella, the woman who owns this hotel in which they're staying, and who may or may not be gaslighting Evie, you know, may or may not be, well, is trying to seduce Richard, we find out. The way you write about her, for a good portion of the story, I was genuinely convinced she was going to be a vampire.
Amazing. I love vampires. They're one of my favourite things.
I thought, she's going to be a vampire. That's what this is. She's a Greek vampire on a Greek island, or maybe she's Texan, weird accents. They've got stuff there we don't quite understand. Yeah, she isn't a vampire, but she is. I will back myself by saying, at the very least, she is somewhat vampiric.
Yeah.
It leads me to ask about something that I think goes back to the vacation gothic. Hotels, there's an inherent creepiness, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's because I guess I don't know. Has every hotel room had somebody die in it? Probably. Literally on the bed that you're sleeping in. And, you know, like sometimes you can even see like weird blood stains on pillows and stuff. And when you start thinking about other people sleeping in this bed, having sex, dying. Oh, anyway, sorry, I could get
No,
I
exactly
could be
that though. Exactly that. It's like
so
metaphorical
gross.
ghosts at the very least, even if not
Yes,
literal
yes, yes,
ghosts, right?
yes.
And you're at the mercy of strangers. And I'm just, I mean, I don't go through life terrified all the time, but every time I go to a hotel, I'm like, does someone know I'm here? Because other people have got a key to this door. You know, I remember once in Switzerland. I lived in Switzerland for a year, and me and my friend went hiking and went to this village in the Italian Alps called, well, it was on the border called Candersteg. And honestly, in my memory, this village was the creepiest place known to man. It was just like a sort of, it's like something out of a sort of German impressionistic 30s horror film. And we stayed in this hotel, and for my entire 3 day stay in this hotel, me and my friend didn't see another human being. You checked in with a computer, you checked out with a computer, issued you a key card. There were no other guests. We came down in the morning and there was a table set with breakfast. We never saw waiting staff. We didn't see a single human being. It's one of the most unnerving
Wow.
weekends of my entire life. And ever since that, anytime I read about hotel gothic, I just think, yeah, they are the creepiest places you can be.
I mean, do you barricade yourself into a hotel room if you're in one on your own?
I'm embarrassed to say this, we did that night. My friend was so
Oh,
unnerved. They literally put him under the, under the door handle.
I do that all the time.
But what he didn't realize for 2 days was that there was an adjoining room.
Oh, adjoining rooms are really creepy as well. I mean, just so like twins, like
Do you barricade yourself in?
yeah, always. Unless, I mean, Hilton's are good because you can actually like they give you a little chain, you know, because they know that people who stay in hotels are really paranoid. And so you can like put your door on the latch. But yeah, every other hotel, you're like, well, you know, everybody in this hotel has a key card or a key to this door, and I'm gonna sleep here. And actually, I was asleep in a hotel once with my partner, so luckily not on my own. And then it was actually after the Oligarchy book launch, so I'd had a bit to drink, and you know, there I was fast asleep, and it was, I don't know, maybe 5 in the morning or something. And then people burst into the room, and it was the hotel thought that we were two hotel staff who'd got into a room and were like having an affair, and they'd come in to bust us, but they got the
Oh
wrong
God.
room. It was terrifying.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and I also had a really, I had a genuinely haunted hotel room in the Four Staff in Canterbury. It was so haunted that they gave me a free night, another night in a different room, to make up for the fact that this particular room was so haunted.
When we finish this conversation, I'm going to ask you about that for the Patreon that I'm doing, because
Okay.
I must know. The one story I've got about hotels and creepiness, which is I think will be interesting to a woman from the UK, is that an ex-girlfriend of mine, her mother is the not the reason, but the case which made it, now hotels now you can't get in the lift unless you have a key card.
Oh, I hate that. Oh, that freaks me out.
So
But
that's
yeah.
because of an ex sort of
Oh.
partner's mother of mine, because she was had a stalker and he managed to get into a hotel floor, and she was quite an important person in like public life, and because of that they changed the legislation now so that you can't get into a hotel without having a key card.
Oh no, because that really freaks me out. So I was in Wellington in New Zealand a few years ago, and then they had that system, and I just got to this hotel and I thought, oh, I'll just wander around and see what the gym's like, because you know, I run and stuff. And so I just hopped into the lift without my key card, and then the person that had been in it hopped out and the door shut, and then I couldn't go anywhere or get out. And
Oh, God.
I'm scared of lifts as well, and I'm scared of being confined in small places. So it took me about 2 seconds to absolutely lose my mind and freak out. And then, of course, I couldn't think of, you know,
Oh.
okay, be be calm, why are you here, what's gone wrong. I just, all I knew was that the doors wouldn't open and it wouldn't move. And oh, anyway, yeah, so
I'm sorry, so I brought it up.
no, it's fine. It's horror. Yeah. It's cool.
The final creepy detail, we've got the hotel, we've got everything else, but is this storm. This storm that comes every year and hammers this Greek island. Had you finished writing this book before the mega storm hit Greece last year?
Yes.
Because I was in that storm.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And reading this brought a lot of that back as well. Because, we were on this tiny island and it rained for 2 days and most of the island washed away into the sea. We came down to the beach. Wow. There were cars in the sea, all sorts of stuff. So I wonder whether you'd actually experienced it, because you write about it pretty accurately.
Oh, well, that's good. I mean, it's not good, but it's good. You know what I mean? No, it was simply that when I was on the actual island that I used as inspiration for the novel, there was this kind of cafe owner who literally did say, well, you know, at the end of the season, the storm will come and wash away the beach, just like it is in the novel. And that just stuck with me because I thought, oh, that's, you know, I wonder if that really does happen, or is that just something they say to the tourists, or, you know, like, but I thought, what if it really did happen? And clearly, you know, it really does in some places.
I think the one I was in, I think it was like kind of quite a generational thing. I think it was like the most rainfall Greece had ever had in a 24-hour period or something. We counted and there was like a flash of lightning every 10 seconds for about 8 hours. It was insane. It was like the end of the world. I was waiting for Cthulhu to emerge from the ocean. It was nuts, you know. I mean, it was fine. I just sat in a cafe eating gyros and reading books, so it was fine, but it was pretty scary. Well, actually, speaking of reading books, that brings us to my final two questions. And my first one, I think you've already hinted at this, but can you recommend a book for my listeners and tell us why you've picked that one?
Yes, I can, but I'm not sure if it's one that will have been recommended before, because we've talked about Shirley Jackson, and it is Hangs a Man by Shirley Jackson.
No, we get a lot of, We've Always Lived in the Castle. Yeah. I don't think we've had Hangs a Man before.
Yeah, but it's amazing because it's properly weird. I'm not saying We've Always Lived in the Castle isn't, because that's a big favourite of mine. I absolutely love that novel, but Hangs a Man it's weird, it's funny, and it's got this kind of slightly Patricia Highsmith-y, stylish vibe, you know, so it's this girl goes away to college and there's a whole long section about drinking martinis with the faculty and the weird young wife of the professor and stuff. And by the way, if listeners, if I'm getting any details wrong, it's because I did read it quite a while ago, but it really stuck with me in how actually frightening it is about a kind of breakdown and psychologically, you know, how weird things can get. So I won't say any more than that, but it's just, yeah, for Shirley fans out there who haven't read that one, it's amazing.
Okay, it's one that I've seen getting a bit more traction recently. I've seen more people mentioning it, so I think it's perhaps riding the crest of a wave of the Hill House and Always in the Castle has kind of rekindled, maybe, to mix my metaphors. yeah, okay, well, thank you for that. And my last question, when was the last time something really scared you?
That's a great and disturbing question, and I had loads of potential answers. I'm not sure if people understand why this was scary, but it was also funny as well. I had a minor collision when I was parking my car. I'd kind of backed in something, just a tiny bit, and I got out and looked, and there was no damage, and it was all fine. So, you know, went about my life. And then a few days later, I looked at the back of my car, and it had a massive dent in it. And I just thought, oh dear, what, did I not notice that the other day when I crashed into that car? How did I do that? And I really freaked out. And for a few days, I went around thinking, well, I must have been in some weird fugue state, or if I'm capable of doing that much damage to my car and not noticing, like, what is wrong with me? So I was really, really frightened about my own kind of state of mind until I found this note that somebody had left on my car, but I hadn't noticed for several days, with a number and a registration, and they'd actually just crashed into me when I was parked somewhere else. So I'd managed to have kind of two weird little car accidents, one I knew about, one I didn't know about, and conflate them together. But just, I guess I'd kind of, I guess it was a form of, I don't know, self-gaslighting or something, because it didn't take much for me to think, that's it, I've gone mad, I've lost it, I'm just crashing my car and not knowing. So yeah, that was the last time I was genuinely frightened kind of about myself.
I completely get that
I'm good.
because I am somebody who spends, I've discussed this on the show quite recently. I have this thing that was diagnosed by a therapist as metacognition, where I'm
Oh.
constantly analyzing my own thoughts. How very postmodern of me, right? I'm constantly like ransacking my head. Why did I think that? Why did I think that? What does that thought mean? You blah, blah, blah. Did I forget that? Why did I remember that? And it gets me to a state of high anxiety. So if ever I do something where I feel like I can't judge my memory or my thoughts about it or stuff like that, it sends me into a complete tailspin. So I would react in exactly the same way.
Oh, maybe I have that thing too then, because all of the things you just said are things that I do too. And yeah, I was just, it kind of completely unsettled my whole world, because I thought, if I could do that and not know, what else have I done?
Yeah, completely. It's why I never want to see a ghost. Not because I'm inherently scared of ghosts, but because I'll spend so much time worrying over, did I see it? Am I mad because I saw it? Does the blah, 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 you know,
Oh,
just, yeah. Really could do
yeah.
without thinking about my own senses all that much if I can help it. So completely get
Yes,
that one. Yeah.
same.
And how fitting a fear on the off the back of a conversation that's all about interpretation and memory and stuff like that. So nicely tied together in a big, lovely bow.
Oh, good. Oh, that's good. That's what we want, isn't it?
Well, we've talked for a while here, because of the edits and the little problems with the recording and the start stopping and starting. It feels like I've been talking to you all afternoon, but it's been an absolute pleasure. Really has. Say it every week, but as I say, your book and your career and everything means an awful lot to me. So thanks for writing The Sleepwalkers. I had a great time with it, and just thank you ever so much, Scarlett, for talking scared.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Neil. And I've had an absolutely great time. Your questions have been amazing. It's been a pleasure. So thank you so much.
Loved it, loved it, loved it. Seriously, that was a thrill for me. Such a full circle moment. I read most of Scarlett's stuff in awe and amazement and a bit of glorious confusion when I was slogging through the early years of my thesis. I was trying to write a lengthy chapter all about fiction that internalizes critical theory as part of itself. And her novel, The End of Mr. Y, this book that I keep entreating you to read, it does that. It takes all the stuff that I sometimes allude to on this show, Jean Barthe, Baudrillard, people like that. I say allude to rather than state because I've forgotten most of the finer points of their arguments. Anyway, and Scarlett's book takes all of that and somehow uses it to fuel this hysterically fun novel. The End of Mr. Y is like if The Matrix was made with a British kitchen sink sensibility. Such a good book. Go read it. And read Popco and Bright Young Things and Oligarchy and The Seed Collectors, the one that I haven't read with all the sex. Read them and report back to me how much you love them, because I'm convinced you will love them. But you'll also love The Sleepwalkers. And there isn't much more I can say without puncturing the perfect seal that Scarlett and I maintained around its secrets. I'll just reiterate that it is probably her most immediately genre novel, the most overtly adherent to a thriller template. Yet it's also not quite like any other thriller you've ever read. It's so funny, yet so dark, and you'll find yourself cringing at the things you laughed at once you know why they aren't quite so funny. I really loved it. It's not horror, but fuck it, it's horrible in parts, and it's super gothic, hot gothic. I'm using that term from now on. If you do read The Sleepwalkers, tell me your thoughts on Richard in particular. Is he a monster? Is he a victim? Somewhere in between? I gave a very vacillating, caveating answer when Scarlett asked me, not because I'm scared of saying either way, I have an opinion, but one, I don't want to spoil it for you guys, and two, the need for that caveat is built into his character and into his story. You'll see what I mean when you read it. Read Richard's full story and then think what would happen if he was a real person and they were real events. It's a complex, challenging idea for a book and probably not one to discuss on Twitter. You can reach me on Twitter to discuss any of that. You can reach me on Twitter or Insta or Threads at TalkScaredPod or email me at TalkingScaredPod@gmail.com. I've got to reiterate, right now I'm not really open to requests to read books or to book guests. It's early April 2024 when I'm saying this, so if you hear this in the future, that may not be the case, but right now I am rushed off my feet. You'll be glad to hear, though, the writing's going well. I rarely get to say that, but I've committed to some short stories and they are coming together happily. I found it much more enjoyable of late. I'm writing one tale about an old man and a very brave dog called Riot, and I think you'll like that one if it ever gets published. And King said I was a good writer on Twitter. Mad tweet. He said it in relation to my article for Esquire about Carrie being 50 years old. I'm still floating 3 feet above the ground, to be honest, because for your idol, a man who you revere for his writing, to say that you have some semblance of the right stuff, well, I feel motivated as hell. And that tweet was like literary cocaine. So yeah, hopefully you'll see a lot of stories from me soon. If you want to support this creative endeavour, then the Patreon is always there for you. Patreon.com/TalkingScaredPod. You get loads and loads of bonus stuff. Also, all reviews are hugely welcome, whether on Apple, Spotify or elsewhere. Just thank you very much, however you choose to support Talking Scared. I'm back next week with a big bombastic roundtable. I'm joined by Ceresia J. Fennell, Desiree S. Evans, Monica Brashears and Eden Royce for a conversation about the new anthology, The Black Girl Survives in This One. A set of stories which kind of does what the title says. It puts black girls at the centre of a horror story and they survive. But to quote Texas Chainsaw Massacre, what will be left of them? The book's out now and just don't miss the conversation. Until then, keep your valuables safe, pop a chair under your bedroom door, but do try to enjoy your moments of sunshine. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.